quick 15-second promo for Purple Stride in April. Go!
PurpleStride.org.
/Team Trek.
We're a team! We're a team!
There's our leader, Kitty! Our vision of hope!
Hey, this is Terry Farrell of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and I'm here to invite you to join me and the Inglorious Trekspurts as we go on the ultimate road trek, visiting the most iconic Star Trek locations ever filmed. We'll share fun facts about scenes that were filmed there, their incredible Hollywood histories. We may even fight a Gorn or two along the way. We have many special guests from Star Trek movies and series. You can reserve your copy of this epic new documentary on Blu-ray or DVD, along with a gaggle of intergalactic rewards, such as Ernie, the pet Vasquez rock, limited edition collector pins, cool sci-fi swag, autographs, of course, and so much more, by going to makethetrek.com and supporting us as we boldly go to the greatest Star Trek locations ever filmed. Go to makethetrek.com and let's see what's out there. Engage.
Hey, if you're a fan of the Inglorious Trekspurts, you don't want to miss Deck 78, our subscriber-only podcast, which deals with pop culture and Trek-adjacent subjects. It's a pretty spectacular podcast with amazing guests and conversation every other week. And the only way to get it is to subscribe today. So go to treksportsplus.com. That's treksportsplus.com to subscribe to Deck 78. Fire the rockets. Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
And this is Darren Dockerman.
And this is Ashley Miller.
And we are the Inglorious
Trekspurts. And today we're celebrating the legacy of Star Trek Picard Season 3, 1 year later. Yes, it's been a year since the debut of Star Trek Season 3.
Thank you. Admiral. I received a distress call from Beverly Crusher.
We are being hunted.
Who is it out there?
I don't know.
We must run.
From what?
Precise with your timing, Jean-Luc Picard.
Fire!
You should know that I now prefer pacifism to combat.
We're all gonna die.
They are blind to something big.
It will be what it always was. Attempts on your life.
Worf, Riker.
You broke them into this too?
I was once like her. Irrational, violent.
The Forge! Gun it! Stay inside!
Aye, sir.
There's a darkness on this ship. All-consuming darkness.
I'll peck. And I'll jab. Everything that makes you, you.
We will scorch the earth under which he stands, and the night will brighten with the ashes of the Federation.
But first, we will have vengeance.
Fire everything we've got!
Greetings. Old friends.
Lore. And for many of us, it marked the triumphant return of something we know and love, Star Trek. And we were lucky enough to sit down at GalaxyCon once again with the great Terry Metalis, executive producer and showrunner of Picard Season 3, and talk about the lasting legacy that the show has left, as well as the challenges of mounting that remarkable season, as well as the less remarkable Season 2, which he was briefly involved with, and has some great stories about that as well, and we haven't really talked about that.
And this time he was live. He was live in the hall. A year ago we had had him as a first guest, and he was a speaking head on a view screen.
Yes. Guilty.
You know, that was guilty. That was a really, great get for us, because we did our Inglourious Trexperts panel, last year. And it was our first time in Richmond. And we thought, the show is just about to debut. Wouldn't it be great to have Terry beam in and participate in the panel, which was a real treat for everyone who attended that panel. The show became wildly popular with fans. And
we're not saying it was because of our podcast, but...
But, it was because of our podcast.
There's not a zero of interest compared to us. So,
and Terry has subsequently been on the podcast many times, most recently for our 300th episode celebrating Star Trek 3 with Kevin Feige and Steve Asbell. And that was a really terrific episode a couple of weeks ago. But it was great to have him stag, because we've had him on the show recently with Todd, which is always, it's always a delight to have Todd Stashwick with us. But this was a chance for us to really go back and examine how they did it, how they pulled it off,
and how the sausage was made,
and how the sausage was made in the replicator. And we're all fans. We're all fans of Season 3. There's a great Blu-ray DVD out of it with some great commentary and deleted scenes and extended scenes. And if you haven't seen it, or you want to relive the fun of Picard Season 3, you want to check that out. It's available from Paramount Home Video. So what do you think the legacy of Star Trek Picard Season 3 is, guys?
Well,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, besides the, the obvious wordplay of legacy and all the talk about that, I think that certainly for now, we can just enjoy Season 3 for what it is, a wonderful ending to the story of the next generation.
Denouement.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
Coda,
that's right.
Epilogue.
I think on a larger level, here's the lesson of Season 3. To anyone who doubted or had harbored doubts that Star Trek, as we know it and love it, could be relevant and popular today, I mean, that is the evidence that something is very right.
There it sits.
There it sits waiting to be watched. And you know what? It should be watched. And if there's God looking out for ships named Enterprise, then maybe Picard Season 3 is the roadmap for how to make Star Trek feel like a modern show, but still feel like Star Trek.
But, if that isn't in the cards, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
I think
it's still great.
It's a good way. It's a good way to let them be.
Yeah, and to say goodbye.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the future of Star Trek, but we're going to do that after we share this wonderful interview with Terry Metalis with you after these brief commercial messages.
I believe in the old things, family, friendship, fairness. That's what this country's all about. Taking it to the edge, laying it all on the line. I watch your tail, you watch mine. I value human life. Hey, we're all on the same side.
T.J. Hooker, he's with you.
The Inglourious live tour continues as the Trexperts make their way across this fine country of ours, to all kinds of great convention goodness. You can see us next in Trek Conderoga as we join Jonathan Frakes, Brent Spiner, and Clint Howard for some Tranya at the Star Trek Tour. Darren?
It's going to be amazing, particularly because it's going to be the first time that Mark Altman visits the Star Trek original series set tour. And I'm going to be there to watch every minute of it.
And me can't too. Wait. Not a hologram, not an imaginary story, but real, live. You can touch me, but only if you pay extra. Don't touch me. Don't touch me. Don't look
and
at
don't
me.
And don't try and steal his coffee.
I can't wait. And of course, Memorial Day weekend will be in Oklahoma City for the inaugural Oklahoma City show from GalaxyCon in July.
In July,
Ashley and I will be at San Diego Comic-Con. Well, Darren, tell the folks where you'll be.
I will be in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm going to debut a little something about Star Trek the Motion Picture.
I would go, but I can't pronounce it. Right. And then, of course, in September and August, sure, we're going to find our way to San Jose as we're reunited, and it feels so good, for the inaugural San Jose GalaxyCon. And we're looking forward to seeing a lot of you up there. It's going to be a really fun one.
That's exciting. Is that the right word?
It is exciting.
It's exciting.
It'll be the only time it takes you guys less time to get to a convention than it does me.
That's true. We can walk there in the time it takes you to get there.
Yeah.
And this fall, Ashley and I will be doing Nightmare Weekend back in Richmond. I know what restaurants we won't be going to. And we bring it on all home at Columbus, Ohio, at GalaxyCon. So for more information, go to galaxycon.com, comiccon.org, and StarTrekTour.com. And you can see us at one or all of these amazing conventions. And we can't wait to see you there. Always great to see our listeners join the expedition. So until then, keep on trekking ingloriously, of course, all the way to GalaxyCon, Star Trek Tour, and Comic-Con.
And the last member of that podcast, we're thrilled to have with us today. Once again, we're sitting down 1 year later with the showrunner and executive producer of the great Star Trek Picard Season 3, very important, I say Season 3, Terry Nazaris.
You're in the sandwich. That exit from this.
Terry, was your first convention in Richmond last year for Star Trek 3? For Star Trek 3?
It was Seattle. Seattle,
okay. So you weren't here last year?
No. Was I here?
Oh, that's amazing.
How is that?
Yeah.
No, I was in my office. Two big drinks.
Yeah, that was right. You were right on the screen and we interviewed you
Via
remote.
So, 1 year late.
Well, it was a technical disaster. No, it was great. It was a technical disaster at the beginning because they couldn't get you on screen.
It was like, now Mark is trying to communicate with regular ones.
But we couldn't make it work. But then when it was you wrong, it was great.
What's Carol Marcus from?
But the thing that is interesting, I remember we talked to you before the show premiered. So we were like avoiding, like we were talking about, what do you think of the Star Trek movies? And what do you think of this? Is that the future? And like we were getting all these generic questions because you couldn't really talk about the show yet.
Right.
Now you can.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about, and then we'll open it to questions because we know you got a lot of questions for Terry. But it's been a year since the show premiered. What surprised you the most about the reception?
Lots of exciting things. I think the reaction to Todd Stasher against Matt Shaw, I think, was good. That was something, he was on my previous show, 12 Monkeys, so we wrote that more specifically for him. But we knew that, bless you, that some people are going to have an allergic reaction to anybody saying no to Patrick Stewart or Jonathan Frakes, and so, well, we didn't know. And so it was really nice to watch people kind of fall in love with Todd, because we all love him too.
I also thought, I remember watching the first episode and thinking, I love this character, but I wonder if people are going to embrace him because you know, he's so mean, not only to the people he loved, but you know, and he made all the right decisions for the right reasons, but you know, he's saying no, famously, or mean, to everyone. And like, are people not going to like that? Because they seem to embrace more of the touchy-feeling.
Well, they didn't. In fact, I think there was a line in the trailer where he said something like, I think they did the bit, he's like, well, we won't be blowing things up. It's like a whole, like, oh, Star Trek is off the rails
again.
It's about blowing things up.
I'm
like, well,
yes, it's
the
Moriarty was the great big bad of the season.
I know, but there are people who wanted that too. So it was, I think, you know, it's, when he first came out in that first season, there was a lot of Twitter tweeting. Doing the Twitter thing, hating on it, but it was pretty quick. I think by the next episode, when you can understand that this guy is—he's just right. Like that was the role of the writer. For this guy can't be wrong about anything he's saying. He just doesn't have to be nice being right.
But how great was it to follow the audience's turn?
It was great. Not on Twitter. Twitter is like a live studio audience. And with Star Trek, that is a room of people throwing things like a bar fight with bottles.
It's Jerry Spring.
Yeah, so it's impossible to gauge popularity because the loudest could be the negative, most negative, or just not into what you're doing. It really actually wasn't until ratings and articles, reviews, and honestly, people here meeting. And talking to them, and I was like, oh, I think this is Edge of Infinity, and folks like that were like really into it. So that was probably when we really knew it was over.
Yeah, because we had this whole little sewing circle of friends.
You saw it very early.
We saw it very early, and there were only a few other people, but it was like all like people in the business, and we're like, can you believe how good this is? And we asked each other, is this really as good as we think it is?
Yeah, it was good.
I was like, you couldn't believe it.
I remember when someone told me Mark Alden saw it, and I was like, oh.
Because remember, Michael Piller told me the Antichrist was Star Trek at one point.
And he liked it. But I listened to this podcast, and we famously disagree on Star Trek 3.
That's
and,
fine.
Which is an excellent episode, which is what all of us do.
It's the gateway drug to a podcast.
It was last year, 2 weeks ago. So I really did not think that we were going to do it. And then when I got that email, you know, I was like, oh my God, we
don't want to. I'll make an admission I had never made publicly before. I did not think I was going to like it.
No, I knew. There's no way. You got that thing and were saying, oh boy. It was really nice to hear your response and hear your response. Well, Ashley's response.
And we talked about this before, because you get Star Trek. And it's not that just you get it from watching it. You love Star Trek. You grew up loving Star Trek. And then, of course, you worked on Star Trek, and you saw everything they did right and wrong on Voyager and Enterprise as an intern, and later as an assistant to Brad Bradley. You know, how much do you think your approach to Picard was forged by that experience?
Oh, wow. It would be impossible to say, you know, because I sit there, I just never thought about the opportunity, but I remember when Enterprise, I was there when Enterprise premiered, and they were bringing it together, and they were bringing together the opening credits, which they, I think, there should be kudos for them trying to do something different. And when they cut it, it was to U2's Beautiful Death, right? And it was just, it really like worked. Like this, it does feel different and it does feel elevated. And then there were the Paramount's like, well, we don't own Beautiful Death. We need a song that we can own. And then that other song came out. And I remember going, this is not the right way to do this.
He did not have
to. And I said to Brandon, he was like, no, I think it's gonna be good. So you take things like that, those lessons of, because I can see the doubt in his eyes. You know, it's like that.
I saw fear in Klingons.
You can see it.
when there's a voice in the back of my head or that says you should say something, I will now listen to that more. There's a thing on set, like, how do you know if a tape is good, or how do you know, like, a cut of an episode is good? And it's like, it's not here. It's like, it's here. It's a feeling. But you have to be sensitive to it. You may not know what it is that's wrong. But you have to say, all right, hold on.
Something's wrong.
And you don't have any time. If you're on set, you have no time. You've got, like, 5 minutes to figure out what is wrong before you have to move on with your day. So I would say that I'm probably more, I've grown up with that, more sensitive to that voice, listening to it.
Well, I think we both, and Ashley too, were in the showrunner's training program. And what is the one thing that takes you really good?
Where's Ashley?
Yeah, he
got better offer.
Oh, I see. So the one thing they teach you above all else is the worst decision you can make is no decision.
Yes.
And then you have to be able to make a decision, right or wrong, but not to sort of like,
Yeah, it's true. It's sometimes it's terrifying. The moment that I almost had to do that was within season 3 was Fenton Years. There was a problem getting a hold of Lisa. He was the only guy we really loved to play Picard's son. This thing, you can reduce the idea of the son of Jean-Luc Picard. You have to have somebody who can stand up on his own. It's Patrick Stewart, and feel like it came from the DNA of Beverly Crusher and Jean-Luc Picard.
That's what they said about Tom Hardy.
Right. Yeah. No, but Tom's like an excellent actor. I mean, like, Horace, there is all, you know, great, whether or not you enjoy that movie or not. The visa was not, there was problems. I forget, it's like when I'm in Syria, this whole thing. They're like, we're not going to wait any time. You have to pick another choice. And I had to. I was holding on to the last minute. And fortunately, that guy just dragged his feet. And then the last second, I got a text. I woke up to a text from Ed. He's like, my visa came through. I'm on a plane. And I was like, thank God. Because I don't think it would work. I really don't think it would work without Ed.
And sometimes things just go right. And then by the grace of God, because imagine that guy's deal would close sooner. And then Ed was available.
Yeah.
That's wild. And of course, Ed is so great in the show.
Yeah.
And that's a hard role. We talked about this on the podcast. You know, Merrick Brecher is Kirk's son. Thankless role, poor guy. You know, he gets Kevin. He's very hard to play, you know, the son of William Shatner. And, you know, particularly then, when they were so young and vibrant and didn't have that role. You know, Merrick, with all due respect, is not very good as Kirk's son. Ed pulls it off so brilliantly in the show. And, you know, obviously you could see building a whole new show on the back of Ed, if anyone ever gets the idea to do such a thing,
right? The,
it would be like a legacy series.
It was interesting because when we were developing, how we got to the part son was, I asked myself, what is the last unexplored relationship that he hasn't had yet on screen? It kind of already got a daughter with Sophie, and I was like, it should be a son. And I'm like, well, the second we do that, everybody's going to be like, you're just doing Wrath of Khan. Like, the difference is, in our mind, was Kirk knew we had a son and legitimately just stayed away, which is a whole other kind of character. That says a lot about Kirk. Think about it, that he's able to do that.
He did what he wanted.
Right, but that being, he never checked in anyway.
Yeah.
We couldn't do that with Carter. And especially if it was with Beverly, I was like, there's no way we just retcon that. So we needed a really legitimate reason. And so that to us felt in the fact that we were going to have 10 episodes to explore a relationship where you retcon that a scene,
you know,
that, right? And, sure. And nothing in it.
And his letter does. Absolutely.
Right.
It didn't happen.
You were harsh on it.
No,
David,
no, I love our
joke. So and throw ideas, but they, you know, you have to do things a certain way. I mean, so much of the show is set on the ship, and it works. It doesn't matter. You don't feel like you're always on the ship.
Right.
Because interesting things are happening.
Right. Plus, we got to do other, like the gravity well, like the idea of the sinking ship, that feeling of like, that's a good drama. You know, and to put Frakes through that, I mean, I think Jonathan Frakes probably is the biggest round of applause for this season.
So good. So good.
You know, Saturday morning.
As are you, apparently,
but
and a WGA nominee,
yeah,
and a bunch of other awards have been lavished on the show, which is wonderful, and nominations galore.
That's been pretty fun. Yeah.
And the Altman Award.
The Altman Award.
Best Director Show of the last 25
years. And the Leg Lamp Award. It's a major.
But yeah, I gotta ask you, because the other thing that's, I think, what is interesting is a lot of people, you know, they all have, why did you choose this person for the larger, or why would a non-enterprise character do this? And so you did, you had an enterprise character, you had Vitalis Prime. Interesting that of all the things you could have brought back, that was what you...
Yeah. So that became, that was the sort of center. So a long time ago, it's 2002, when I was in Sicily on Enterprise, the writers needed a name for the shittiest place in the universe. And they said it a couple times. It was like a gas plant, gassy kind of, but it's Ashley. What the hell?
Come on up here.
Oh, yeah. So, they named it Metallus Prime. And so when we went down the road of this terrible, crime-ridden world that we're going to spend time on, the writer was like, why don't you bring back that? I was like, okay. The problem was, I didn't think this would happen, because I didn't think anybody cared. Like, a certain... I never thought people would know the name of the show, right? You know what I mean? It's just not in...
You have seen Star Trek before.
I know, but I just didn't... And so people were like, oh, he named the system after himself.
Roddenberry Prime.
Right, exactly. It was really just to go back to the Enterprise thing. But God bless my God.
Admiral Harpeth.
Yeah. Hey, that was great. I thought he was...
Oh, my God.
No, you don't like him. No, I like Star Trek 5, but Harpeth.
He's terrible.
He's a natural.
He's a natural.
I thought he was fantastic.
You know, Harpeth, so the producer... 2, 3, 4, 5 plays an admiral
dressing a little casually
in Star Trek 5.
I thought it was believable. I felt like they were old friends.
He was believable as a non-actor.
I want you to go to industry.
That's not what he said.
That's exactly what he said.
So, but you know, we know a lot. We focus a lot on obviously. The success of season 3. But it's unfair in the sense that, you know, you did help get season 2 on its feet before having to go to 3 because both shows were, you know, season 2 and season 3 were being shot back to back. Can you just talk a little bit about, you know, once you were on the show, what that experience was like, and then making the move from sort of moving from season 2 to breaking season 3?
Well, yeah, I was the new kid in season 2. In fact, they made the deal with me before I even seen season 1. Season 1 had not come out yet. Once my deal closed, then they showed it to me. So I was like, look, the audience, I didn't know what Picard was about. I didn't know Jurati and Rios, any of these characters. Well, I watched it all one night. Next day, went into a room for season 2 with Michael Chabon and Akiva and a few of the other writers from season 1. So I was pretty quiet because I wanted to soak up.
Well, you had Michael Chabon, his Pulitzer,
yeah,
right? And then you had the Akiva, his Oscar.
Like,
you have a set.
I tried to be as deferential as possible, but they were very receptive. They were like, we don't have any ideas. What do you think it should be? And I said, cute. It was like, minute one. That's the first thing I said. I said, well, it's the first character, really, you know, kind of a firepoint that he has a thing with. I think fascinating to see what Q thought of now, so many years later. And they're like, okay, let's do Q. And then it was, I was like, oh, wow. Okay, let's do it. And then there was, you know, the other issue with shooting in Los Angeles was very expensive. Unless you're doing a shit show, which was with Curtis and Three, was, it's really hard. And this is before COVID dropped, when we started going around. So the notion was that we could do a kind of time travel thing. And what year or not. And so that became the basis. So we queued time travel, the present day time travel. And we had many different iterations of what that could be.
And was there a question as to what year it would be, or was it, did you always know for cost reasons it would be contemporary?
We knew it would be contemporary, but it could have been right before World War III. I think the tricky part was making Star Trek feel like it took place in our world, in our timeline, even though we know and have accepted, many fans have accepted that it's just not. There was a Gen X Wars in the 90s, et cetera, et cetera.
That really happened.
Right. I believe. And so, but I think with Paramount, they were like, well, you need World War III. Nobody wants to talk about World War III. And I think, rightfully so, that would have been a grim. I remember one time I said, well, what if we had somebody said, what if we could make sure World War III happened? I should say everything, right?
Wow, that's like killing Kennedy for the start.
But the biggest, right? Yeah. Killing all, right? So,
even though
an actor can't do that, you know what I mean? But it's a fascinating idea, too. Like, what if you have to do? I mean, because if you stop World War II, what would be different? Maybe we wouldn't be here. Maybe things would have escalated in a different way.
Well, either.
Sorry,
he is a killer,
exactly. But so you know, I think it's tricky to deal with canon history. They struggle throughout. I mean, can you plausibly say the search for four took place in a post-eugenics war Earth? I bring it to you too.
Well, since there were no whale participants in the eugenics
right
world, well, but
it does seem like the 1980s.
Khan was a big fan of Italian.
Right.
Sorry.
Oh, what's happening?
When, you talked a little bit about this recently, that there was more of a sci-fi element that sort of, by necessity, you abandoned, but that was a part of the second season. Just the idea that there would be, you know, aliens on Earth, sort of in a Men in Black way that most people weren't aware of.
Men in Black probably not the right tone to try to call, but that idea that we were unaware that of visitors, it was kind of a way station between places, and they don't interfere. That kind of bar was a. The back of the bar was, you know, the cantina. Was a really interesting idea, but
there was a Casablanca element, which is interesting because Casablanca had been a huge influence on Deep Space Nine.
Yes,
on building Deep Space Nine, where Michael and Reagan really talked about, okay, we're going to do, you know, contrary to everybody's says, oh, they're ripping off Babylon 5, which they weren't. Everybody was doing their own thing. Babylon 5 was doing his thing, Deep Space Nine was doing his thing. It just so happened they were both doing the same thing.
Right.
But the idea was Casablanca, you know, on a space station. And obviously that became a really interesting concept. It is interesting to wonder had that happened, you know, how that maybe season would have been different. But of course that season was also shining by COVID, which created this huge, you had to do a lot of exterior scenes, you had to keep on
COVID and everything. It forced us to redevelop.
start the writer's room for season three,
halfway through shooting season two. But in season two, we have like a year, whole year of development.
Really?
We
not that long?
With, because of COVID.
Right.
And they sort of kept us at work. But it also gave them time to look and reevaluate things. So, and for budgets, you say, like, we're not this crowd of 50 people, it's 10.
Had you moved to a virtual writer's room at that point? Or
yeah. Yeah, for COVID, we went into a virtual writer's room. Where? Oh my gosh. It was an interesting time.
Well, that must have been really difficult. No, because nobody had ever really done that before. There wasn't the technology before Zoom, really, to do it. And that's a whole different month. I mean, it's a whole different day.
And now it's standard. Yeah. There's a lot of things that are just, I won't do those. I will, obviously, if I had to. But it is a very different dynamic than to just be in a room with people and talk, but to be in little squares. You really don't communicate the same way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was crazy. We were in the art department, and we had to do that too. And we had weekly, or sometimes daily Zoom meetings. And it's just such a different, difficult dynamic to get creative things flowing. Everyone's working on their own, basically.
Yeah.
And even though I was really excited about the Gary Seven angle, and I got to redesign the servers. I wanted more of that.
Do I like it? I like Darren's work.
But I did like that, because that's one of my favorite episodes.
Oh, there you go.
Well, he loves his son, Vern. That's what I just said.
Right.
And I do love Gary Seven and his son, Vern. Yeah.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Sure I do.
You too?
Yeah.
What's not to like?
I really like
it. I wanted that spin-off series. I really did.
The catalyst is silly. I get a lot of nods up front, too.
Because interesting. Terry Garr is charming.
Love Terry Garr. Who doesn't like the cat?
I think that's
great. It's a good dog. I would say it's my favorite.
It's my favorite. That's not my favorite either. I think you characterize this in the show. There's the masterpieces, the classics, like City and Doomsday Machine, and then there's, the
bread and butter.
But then there's the meat and potatoes, bread and butter. And Assigned on Earth is falls in that bread and butter meat and potatoes episodes.
Really? Yeah, I don't think it's kind of like the centric dish that they added truffles and chocolate to.
No.
Oh, no, this is
going
to work?
No.
All right, well.
No, I don't agree.
That's great.
Right.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, Terry, it's a fun story, and you should just dive into it, because everyone loves a little side trip to adventure.
Hey, you got it right from Two Rodberries now.
Is that Rodberries?
That's official.
Yeah.
Who took me on this?
Yes, the Rodberries. So tell us about, you start breaking it, and time is of the essence, and you're doing it virtually, which slows things down.
Or this is season two.
And now you're on season three.
Season three, we moved back into.
You moved back, okay. And you had a lot of your staff for 12 Monkeys, so it was shorting.
Yeah, very, very good. And we needed that because we were behind. We didn't have a lot of time to put it together. We had the least amount, actually, of all of those three seasons. But it was a story that came together pretty fast. It could be because they were like, it's yours now, we want to do it. Like, I'm trying to set up the typewriter, was gone. The typewriter. I was so inspired, especially when we said we were going to bring the next-gen cast back. It was just like, oh my God, we could do this. We could actually do this, tell one final story. It sort of just, I didn't want us.
Did you have to get, how hard was it to get buy-in from Patrick on that? Because, of course, he famously said when he announced the show, this is a whole new show. This is not Next Generation Season 8. This is exploring a different period of my life. I don't want to have the original. He was very, outspoken about all this. Obviously, Marina and Jonathan did an episode, but he did not want this to be a reunion show. He said it many times. So how difficult was it for you to get Patrick to buy in to the idea of this being bringing back the whole cast?
Well, he had warmed up to I think Woody came back, and John Delancey came back, and the thing with Marina and Jonathan in the first season was at the best time. So, and with John directs, you know, he was directing lots of tubes, he was there. So, I think he was about as kind as could be, but I was still really nervous.
And he knew it was last season.
He knew it was the last season. I think, look, it was still called Star Trek Picard, and that was where I led with it. This is a story about you and your son. And one by one, they would come back and support you on this thing, this mystery that would go. I knew the whole that it was about the son of the cutest. That's the things we pass on that we really don't want to pass on. It was just a father's story of you know, if any of us have kids, you pass on, like, look for all the good things about yourself to pass on. And then when you see the bad, you're like, oh no. And it was sort of, you know, Batman and the Joker, Moriarty and Sherlock or Kirk and the Klingons, right? It felt like the one story that should be at the end, the bookend. But I think once we just sort of presented it that way, because it's a deeply personal story, there wasn't any objection at all. He saw it.
And was that true of most of the cast, or
everyone else? Yes, that was. They were pretty easy, actually, and all in entirely on the same page, which was rare. There wasn't any objections to anybody's story. In fact, they didn't push it further. Like, no, go further, go further. They didn't want to be doing 1990s Hollywood, right? You know what they didn't want to do of the week. They were watching Succession. They were watching premium streaming things too, and they're like, "We want to be able to do that."
Well, and in 1990s television, nobody was asking them what they wanted to do,
right?
And here they had all this. You know, obviously they had a lot of sway. You know, or at least you would hear them out. They had their day at court. You know, what do you think would happen with this character? And they would get to say,
"I just didn't ever want them once the show ended to stand up on stage and say." I wanted to do this, and I didn't want to do that. You know, but so.
Yeah, if you could win a Marina, you could win them all.
Right.
We have about 10 minutes.
Oh, so we do some good questions. Before we do that, let's start lining up with this to ask some questions. So you just got back from the cruise, and it's clear that the Star Trek family really is a family.
Why
do you
want to
go?
No,
oh, okay. Yeah. You're in San Francisco.
San Francisco.
And it looked like you guys were having such a good time. You always do when you're with them, the Saturn Awards, everything else. It really is such a great family. Of course, your bromance with Todd Stashford that never ends.
Yeah.
So, there has to be Star Trek legacy, only to give Todd gainful employment in whatever capacity you bring it back.
Well, or you get something else. Yes, sir.
Time agents. So Garrison had no play in that plot of the time agents, because I know a lot of my friends were like, oh, they're playing off of Gary Sutton.
I believe in the very, I can't say. It'll become my headline and then I'll get in trouble. there was another famous original series-ish character that appeared as a, I can't talk about it, but it was cool. It was interesting. It was cool. But Gary Seven, I think, was Michael and Akiva, I think, had that idea, because they are die-hard series fans and brought that. And in fact, I remember they were like, hey, it's Gary Seven. I was like, oh, no. And they're like, we don't tell you who it is. I was like, no, it's just the one.
See, you don't know.
Thank you.
First of all, Terry, thank you for season 3. And congratulations on the process did you come up with the idea?
Very early on, because you have to ask yourself, what's the last character that has to be on the show? It's the Enterprise. And then you put the Enterprise E doesn't feel warm, fuzzy. Like, it doesn't, because I knew it had to be, if we were going to do it, it's going to be the last 2 hours of the Enterprise. So it's either going to be a brand new Enterprise, which didn't feel right, and floating around the F or the J or whatever it is, and then it was like, how if they could go back to where they started, how would that make sense? And Zian and Geordi, it started to come together as an idea. It felt right to us. But I remember, I was nervous to pitch. I was more nervous to pitch it to LeVar than Patrick, for some reason, I think. And I remember when I was on this film, I was like, you're curator of the museum, and you've got daughters, just. And then when I said, very end, the surprise, the Enterprise D, it's like, I rebuild the Enterprise D. And here's Star Wars is Zoom. And then I started to cry. And he's crying, and I'm on a Zoom, and I'm like, I'm texting my mom, like, run, I hope this gets made. So it was, but it was early on because it just seemed like the most organic way to say goodbye.
How many times did that scare the production when you said we're going to reproduce?
You have no idea. they were like, no, that you can't. Like, we're doing it, so we've got to figure it out. Virtual, we looked at everybody to do it, but we had to.
Okay, so we got to wrap up, but let's do a lightning round. So, quick question, quick answer.
Actually, a second question about the D.
Yes.
It's kind of similar about Hollywood, when the show or franchise ends and all the props and sets get destroyed. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but do you happen to know one way or the other if anything from the D recreation was saved?
Most of it. It's the only set they saved. So I think there's some. They have plans for it. I do know that.
But it's a secret, so you should ask David Glass. I'm sure he'll try.
Yeah.
Okay.
People that are doing that, it's not just in the dumpster somewhere.
No, it's not.
That last two questions, and then you got to wrap.
For Max, Patrick Stewart's work in the Dune, what are your thoughts?
In Dune?
Max isn't here. No, Max isn't here. Max, we interviewed Max. But Max is at the booth signing his book. He loved Patrick Stewart, as we all do with Curry and Adam. Give us a Patrick line.
I will not give you any Patrick Stewart.
That's all. Last question.
Very good question. And Patrick Rico resurrected Prodigy. Shouldn't Patrick be able to resurrect Legacy?
I hope that's up to you, right? We'll see. We will see.
But you're planning to go for Star Trek Legacy, which is like a shaft in space.
Welcome back, and I really enjoyed sitting down with Terry. It's interesting. We've talked to him a lot, but there's always more to tell and to explore because it was such a unique undertaking with so many things working against it and challenges, and I'm really impressed that they were able to pull it off and execute at such a high level.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as we mentioned, it was all a surprise to us, a welcome surprise. But, you know, especially as someone who had worked on season one and two, it came out of nowhere. And it was very surprising and delightful. You know, I'm just sorry that Terry isn't a big fan of, you know, that episode, the Gary Seven episode that I can't remember.
Yeah, that was disappointing. Assignment Earth?
That's the one.
Yeah.
Obviously, the brain scan has ruined me a little bit.
A little bit.
It was so weird what they attempted to do, this weird kind of season two where they she was kind of like supposed to be like from the race that sent Gary. So yeah. I don't know what that was. So
if they'd followed through, it would have been great. But they were just tentative about it.
And yeah, they didn't commit.
Yeah, being careful and tentative about anything is death for drama. Yeah.
And without Isis the Cat, it's not really Gary Seven.
No, it's really not.
You gotta have Isis the Cat.
You know, obviously I admire Picard season three as a creative exercise and as a an expression of Star Trek, and I love it. But you know what? Every time I talk to Terry, I come away with more appreciation of that show and that season of the show as a feat of producing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was not somebody who was given, here's like a carte blanche, here's like all the money you could ever possibly want, no. You know, to make this thing. It's like, well, here's basically nothing. And see what you can get out of it. And look what he got out of it by being a very smart producer. And it just goes to show you, man, like that is so much of the battle. You can have the best ideas in the world. You can have the best intentions in the world, but you got to know how to make it. And you got to know how to make choices. And you got to know how to prioritize. And that was something that I think that Terry just excelled at.
Just the act of making that wraparound in season two happen on the bridge of the Titan.
Brilliant.
And have that fall into the budget of season two. Mm-hmm. Where he knew that he would use it again in season three and didn't really tell anybody about that. That is freaking brilliant. And that's why season three works as well as it does for the budget that it had.
Yep.
Yeah, because he was hoarding his money to protect it so he could do Enterprise 1701D. And that was so brilliant because without that, it would have been a house of cards because that is such a crucial thing to bring back that you bring back all the other characters to bring back the most important character of all, the Enterprise D is so very important. And I was really impressed because people can't imagine what it would have been like to do two and three back to back. That is not an easy a task because they're completely different seasons. Yeah. And to go from the writer's room on two to the writer's room on three in the middle of COVID, it is amazing that the show turned out as well as it did, given all the challenges that they were up against. And they pulled it off. And that is, and to have the cast be so upbeat.
Mm-hmm.
About it because they, at this point don't have to put up a false front, like they did when they were promoting the show back in the day. And over the last 30 years, they've been very critical of a lot of things that happen on Next Gen and a lot of episodes, and they're a lot more candid. But they loved season three. They loved working on it. They, as we talk about, they had, more input, which I think was beneficial in that he was able to take what was good about what they shared about their characters and discard maybe what wasn't. Yeah. But everyone's characters really gets explored in an interesting way. And, most of all, Picard.
Yeah.
Look, the shouts from some aspects of the audience of, this is just fan service. This is just kowtowing to the, let's just say older people in the audience. Yeah. So what?
I mean, but it's shows, not. But it's not fan service.
It's not fan service. It's story service. It's character service. It's giving them their due.
Right. And, it's called a payoff, people.
Yeah.
Fan service is when you want to have somebody travel through time. So you're like, well, what if we just kind of bring back the Guardian of Forever?
Sure.
Even though we don't really have to, and give them a hat. That's fan service, and it doesn't work. I don't know what show that was on though.
No.
But you're exactly right. It's using these characters that we think we know and doing a deeper dive into an exploration because there's a shorthand because we already know them. So now we can go deeper and explore them more in depth. Obviously, this whole idea of Picard being married to Starfleet and not that being the only family he ever needs wouldn't land if he was a character that we never met before.
Right.
And all the time that Geordi is resisting going back to help them because he has a family. He doesn't want to endanger his daughters. I mean, all that and all the data stuff, you know, everything with the cat and lore. And I mean, it's having this, it's backstory. Mm-hmm. It's not with this word that I hate, member berries. If you want that, maybe, you know, well, you watch some of the Star Wars shows. If you just want to see.
And what's great is it also plays on your expectations and switches them around. It doesn't give you everything you would expect from reading the back off of action figures. It is actual depth of character being developed, and your expectations are switched around because you don't know about these characters enough yet. And it's very clever.
Those little references and the connections that it makes to the past, they give us, the show gives us a different point of view on them. There is, I think, you know, other than the opening of The Emissary, the pilot for Deep Space Nine, there's no better recounting of the Battle of Wolf 359 than Shaw. Why? Because here is somebody who is giving us this piece of Star Trek lore to help us understand who he is as a human being and why he seems like such an asshole, but he's really not. I mean, and it's just such a pivotal emotional moment. And that's, and even if nothing else had happened with the Borg, that would have justified it, right? That would have justified talking about it because now we know, now we get him. And the fact that then that paid off again, I think is even better. And it tied together the whole room because there is Seven of Nine, right? Like, you know, it shows she sees the Voyager and, you know, it's not just, oh, hey, look, it's the Voyager model. Right. I mean, in some ways that was teeing up the fact that we were going to see the Enterprise D again, but it was also giving us a little clue about what was about to happen with her and where her journey was going. I mean, so all of those things, like they did multiple jobs. Fan service is just, hey guys, you know,
fan service is seeing a picture of the Ark of the Covenant in the in the catacombs of the Thuggy Temple, right?
Right.
It's different.
Yeah. No, that is so fantastic, and I just think that you know, it's sad. It's sad that they've created this rich new chapter in the Star Trek saga that will go unexplored. Because of course, you know, we're in the early 25th century now in Star Trek lore, and they've postulated a new Enterprise captained by Captain Seven with Ed Spielers as the on board, you know, Picard's son, and any of the classic characters could potentially be rife to guest star. And of course, you have this wonderful character of LaForge's daughter, played by Ashley Chestnut. Just so much that could be done and explored. And you know, I do feel like, you know, as rich and as broad as the Star Trek universe, it does seem that shows that feature the Enterprise seem to be the sweet spot of the Star Trek universe. And
I don't know why that is, because Star Trek is the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
Right.
And the fact that there's been this reluctance to embrace, and we know because of the politics inherent at Paramount and Secret Hideout, you know, why that may or may not be not on the table, but also, of course, the financial issues involving Paramount right now, which is in play, as Wall Street would say. The fact that the Taylor Sheridan shows have done very well. Of course, NCIS, they just launched a spinoff for Paramount because that, you know, procedurals are hot again right now, that maybe there isn't as a big a place for Star Trek. And Star Trek are expensive shows. Yep. And you know, they may be looking to do it for less money. And
let's just say that Gordon Gekko loves Endicott Steel. That's a little deep cut, but
that's a little Wall Street reference for this.
A very Wall Street reference.
But But so, you know, a lot of people are you know, beating the drum and saying, hey, it worked for Bijo. We got Star Trek renewed. We're going to get Legacy to happen. My advice, don't stop, but don't get hung up on it. You know, don't count on it. But don't stop believing, as Fleetwood Mac would say. But I think
it's... Know that God is dead, but believe in him anyway.
Just know that if I were a betting man, my money would not be on Legacy happening, sadly.
Yeah.
But I don't know what Gary Lockwood thinks. Okay.
Gary Lockwood would march right in those offices and punch somebody in the face is what would happen. And they would say, we're not going to do it. He'd say, ew. And then like he'd punch him in the face. It'd be awesome.
Oh, my God. But anyway, always great to have Terry on the show. Always great to have all of you with us. And it was another great GalaxyCon for all of us. And if you've missed us so far, the Inglourious Trek Tour continues throughout the year in Oklahoma City, Raleigh, North Carolina, Columbus, Ohio, San Diego Comic-Con, and San Jose. So check out GalaxyCon.com for more details. You may want to join us for one of these panels live, and you might even be able to ask a question. You might even be on this very show.
Who knows?
Many such journeys are possible. So anything else you guys want to add before we call it a day?
That it's always a pleasure to do these episodes. I know some people are a little tired of the convention on the air that we present here.
Just Karen Walker.
I think it's really nice to be able to let, you know, so many more people enjoy these really fun and unique panels that we do. And I think it's it would be very sad to not be able to share them. And we're thankful that GalaxyCon lets us.
We're so grateful to all Mike and all our friends at GalaxyCon that have brought us into their family, their festival of fandom, and to have these opportunities to share these panels. So it's not just the people in the room, but share it with you, our audience. And all we ask in return is that you support GalaxyCon. When you have a chance to visit one of the great GalaxyCons in your neck of the woods, we hope you'll check it out, because they really put on amazing shows, and we're thrilled and delighted to be a part of them. And very grateful, because we get to meet so many of you, our listeners, at these events, and that's really fun. It's better for you. It's better for us. So on behalf of Ashley Miller, Darren Doctorman, myself, Mark A. Altman, keep on trekking ingloriously, of course, and make it so. Hey, Darren, is this rumor going around that you got a new podcast?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's Trexperts adjacent. It's a fun thing. You know, it's called The Weirded Beardos. Yeah, and before you react, it's Kirk Thatcher, our favorite punk on the bus, and myself just talking about stuff.
But I hate him.
You don't hate him.
No, I'm kidding. I'm doing a song from Star Trek 4. I hate you, right?
I hate you. I berate you.
Oh, yeah. But I don't berate him, and I don't hate him. And if he's involved with you, then I love you.
Well, thanks. And, you know, it's basically just us talking about sort of all things related to our history of working in the industry. You know, together we have like 78 years of experience working in the entertainment biz.
I'm going to have to listen to that. I thought it was about maintaining your beards or something.
It has nothing to do with beards, actually, which is kind of funny. But it's fun. We basically hang out for an hour every other week. So come and join us. Look for The Weirded Beardos on Spotify if you just want to hear the audio. And we're actually on YouTube as well, The Weirded Beardos.
Great. Can't wait to check it out.
Thanks.
First Start to the right and straight on till morning.